I signed up before.
Meeting. This is one that's personal for me because a couple of women in my family have battled breast cancer. So this is on that subject, and it's important. Whereas approximately 1 in 8 women in the United States will develop breast cancer within her lifetime, and whereas breast surgery for treatment of cancer often results in disfigurement, which is known to have a significant effect on a woman's self-esteem and well-being, and whereas restoring a breast is an integral part of breast cancer treatment that's of paramount importance in women's recovery, and whereas the Women's Health and Cancer Rights Act requires group health plans, insurance companies, and health management organizations offering mastectomy coverage to provide women with a notice of these rights when they enroll in the health plan, and whereas most members of the medical community and community at large advocate that all women with a new diagnosis of breast cancer deserve to know that these rights exist so that they can make an educated and thoughtful decision regarding treatment options, and whereas preparing a comprehensive breast treatment plan prior to implementing any treatment modalities has an impact on the overall well-being of a patient. Now, therefore, I, Charlie Hales, Mayor of Portland, Oregon, the City of Roses, do hereby proclaim March 21st, 2013, as Breast Restoration Advocacy Education Day and encourage all residents to observe this day. And, of course, I want to add to make sure that everyone gets regular examinations. So with that, I'm going to call the council to order and ask that the roll be called.
Fritz?
Here.
Fish?
Here.
Saltzman?
Here.
Novick?
Here.
Hales?
Here. We have some communications items. Could you read those, please, Carla?
Item 230, a request of Charlie LaTourette to address council regarding community water fluoridation.
Mr. LaTourette, welcome.
Good morning, Mayor Hills and commissioners. I'm Charlie LaTourette. I'm the executive director of the Dental Foundation of Oregon. We deliver free dental care on a mobile dental clinic called the Tooth Taxi all over the state and particularly around the Portland area. We spend a lot of time in Portland where there is significantly more dental decay than in many cities where there is community water fluoridation. In fact, Portland has 40% more dental decay than kids in Seattle, which has had fluoridation for decades. 40%. I am horrified by what I see almost weekly on our van of kids who come with severe dental decay. In fact, not too long ago, we had a 13-year-old boy who had been suffering with a very badly impacted tooth for over a year, unable to sleep, unable to eat or go to school, and he was in so much pain he tried to pull his own tooth out. Thousands of kids in Portland are suffering needlessly. They're missing school, and they're ending up in emergency rooms, costing the healthcare system a significant amount of money. It doesn't have to be this way. Decades of research and experience has shown that community water fluoridation reduces decay by as much as 25% or more, and it's safe. The CDC has named water fluoridation one of the 10 great public health achievements of the 20th century. Over 200 million Americans already enjoy this public health benefit, but not here in Portland. Every major trusted healthcare organization in the country supports it. Over 3,000 scientific studies spanning 50 years have shown community water fluoridation to be safe and effective. 3,000 studies. It also saves money. Every dollar invested in fluoridation saves $38 in untreated care. That can save our community millions of dollars potentially. And more importantly, it saves thousands of dollars per person, money for families who cannot afford to spend it on care and don't have it. The science is clear, the need is very clear, and it's time we implement community water fluoridation in Portland. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next one, please.
Item 231, request of Dennis Kepis to address council regarding Save the Giant Sequoia Grove in Pier Park.
Good morning.
Good morning, Dennis. Welcome. I think you may know the procedure. You have 3 minutes, and if you're representing an organization, just let us know that.
Sure. I have a folder for each council members.
Thank you.
Appreciate if we could get that there. Okay. My name is Dennis Kipas, for the record. I'm here. The topic I have today is to save the giant sequoia grove and Pier Park. I have a folder. If you open it up, page on the right-hand side, there's a nice picture of our giant sequoia grove. The issue is that there is a bridge and path construction that are too harmful for the giant sequoia grove. The second issue is that there has been a lack of transparency in the process. Chronologically, on December of 2011, personally, my wife and I went to an open house regarding the bridge construction. We asked, are any Pier Park trees to be cut? No. Was the grove to be encroached upon? No. You don't have to worry about your trees, Dennis, they assured me. The bridge at this point was to be built in 2012, but something must have happened because nothing was built in 2012. We remained attentive, but hearing nothing, I was shocked. February 7th of 2013, the tree, a giant sequoia tree, was posted to be removed for the construction. 12 days later, at a Friends of Pier Park meeting, I learned also an ADA path is being built through the center of the sequoia grove. 2 days later, at a mediation, promises were exchanged between the City of Portland and the Friends of the Giant Sequoia Grove. The pertinent promise here is that we were promised to be involved in the design of the ADA path. 7 days later, we learned the ADA path is a 10 by 65 foot slab of asphalt towards the center of the giant sequoia grove where it stops because that's where they run out of money. This is just awful. The root system of a giant sequoia are only about 6 inches deep. They're way too shallow and sensitive to be run over by tires indiscriminately. So we oppose this 10 by 65 foot ADA path. If you right behind the photo is a blueprint of this path, which is a third off-ramp of the bridge. We think the bridge can be strong without it, and we want to be involved in the design of the ADA path as promised. We feel like we can do better than this. We feel like if we all put our heads together and work together, we can do much better than this. So thank you very much, and happy first day of spring.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for coming. Thanks for your advocacy. Okay, Carla.
Item 232, request of Vera C. Poole to address council regarding Portland Alumni Chapter of Delta Sigma Theta Sorority, Inc.
Good morning, Vera.
Good morning. Mr. Mayor Hales and to our city council members, I am Bureau Pool of the Portland Alumni Chapter of Delta Sigma Theta Sorority. On behalf of the Portland Alumni Chapter of Delta Sigma Theta, we thank you for the opportunity to join you to share with you briefly about the year of 2013, which culminates our centennial celebration. On a national level, we started our celebration by participating in the annual Pasadena, California Red Rose Parade on January the 1st with a beautiful float surrounded by our sisters in red and white. First time in the parade history that an African-American float was entered. The following week, the second week in January, we celebrated our Founders Day at Howard University in Washington, D.C., where 22 courageous African-American women on January 13, 1913, established Delta Sigma Theta Sorority, Incorporated. We have over 290,000 members. In July of this year, 28 members of the Portland Alumni Chapter will be joining. As of today, we have 45,000 members who have registered to attend the National Convention in D.C. to celebrate our 100 years of services in the sorority. Locally, on May 25th at the Holiday Inn Airport, we'll be celebrating our 34th year of Women of Excellence and Scholarship Luncheon, where we will award a minimum of 10 scholarship to high school seniors on September 28th, the Portland Illuminate Chapter will host a black and white ball to burn the mortgage on our beautiful, sustainable green building. We are requesting your support and participation. Last but not least, we continue to engage in our five-point programmatic thrust that includes economic development, physical and mental health, political awareness, international awareness and involvement, and education development, I believe. I omitted. We continue to do our mentoring program. We have three mentoring programs for young kids, middle school, high school. We have two for girls, the gyms, and the Betty Shabazz Academy. And we also have one mentoring program for males, which is the Embody program. Embody, empowering males to build opportunities for developing independence. My purpose of being here today, I request from the mayor to present us with a proclamation on our 100th anniversary. And I want to thank you for the opportunity. And also I want just my sisters to stand up this morning to be to acknowledge them. So thank you very much.
Good morning. Well, thank you, Vera, and thanks to you and all the Deltas for all that you're doing for the community. Congratulations. I know you have a lot of friends and supporters here that look forward to you burning that mortgage and other other activities like that in the future here in Portland. So thank you. Great stuff. Okay, next item, please, Carl.
Item 233, request of Janelle C. Jeffries to address council regarding HaHa's homeless proposal.
Good morning, Janelle.
Hi, good morning. My name is Janelle C. Jeffries. I'm a Portland State University Masters of Science and Conflict Resolution student who currently does practicum work with Right to Dream 2. I am also a Right to Survive supporter. I support the Homeless Against Homelessness in America, HaHa's February 27th, 2013 proposal. And I also want to talk a little bit about Right to Dream 2 and homelessness or houselessness, as we like to say in Right to Dream 2. Right to Dream 2's mission statement is, the mission of Right to Dream 2 is to provide a safe place to sleep without interruption and a safe place to be for people in our community experiencing homelessness. According to 2012 estimated data from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development Continuum of Care Homelessness Assistance Programs, there is an estimated 633,782 men and women and children experiencing homelessness in the following: an emergency shelter, transitional housing, or unsheltered. Of that amount, 15,828 were homeless in Oregon, with 4,423 alone in the Portland, Gresham, Multnomah County area. In HUD's 2012 data from the Portland, Gresham, Multnomah County area, the homeless identified that they were the following: 1,025 were chronically homeless, 503 were severely mentally ill, 727 have chronic substance abuse issues, 380 were veterans, 20 were persons with HIV/AIDS, 787 were victims of domestic violence, and 16 were unaccompanied youth under 18. In comparison, as of, according to the 2012 the United States Conference of Mayors and Hunger and Homelessness Survey, a status report on hunger and homelessness in America's cities, a 25-city survey in Portland, Oregon, 16.3% of people live before the poverty line. And to accommodate increased demand, shelters have had to consistently have clients sleep on overflow cots, in chairs, in hallways, or use other subpar sleeping arrangements, convert buildings into temporary shelters, and distribute vouchers for hotel or motel stays because shelter beds were not available. Homeless in shelters have had to turn away both homeless families and homeless individuals. City officials estimate that 70% of the demand for shelter went unmet. In the next year, officials expect the number of homeless families and homeless individuals to increase moderately and resources to provide emergency shelter to decrease moderately. This is from your own study, City Policy Associates, Washington, D.C., at the U.S. Conference of Mayors, page 61. I'm not going to be able to finish this, and hopefully my friend Sophia may be able to continue some of this. But I do want to end with the United the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, adopted by the UN December 10th, 1948, for Article 7. All are equal before the law, and all are entitled without any discrimination to equal protection of the law. All are entitled to equal protection against any discrimination in violation of this declaration and against any incitement to such discrimination. I invite you all to please become an ally of HAHA and Right to Dream 2, and to please drop the fines at Right to Dream 2. Thank you.
Thanks for being here. Thank you. And I think we have one more.
Yes. Item 234, request of Sophia Kinnareth to address council regarding homeless issues in Portland.
Hello.
Good morning.
Okay. My name is Sophia Kinnareth. First and foremost, I want to thank you guys for passing the sick leave ordinance and also for refunding the youth education program for the summer. You guys did the right thing, and that gives me hope for this city. But let me give you some statistics about Right to Dream. We give 12 hours of uninterrupted sleep to an average of 90 people a night. That's 32,850 times a year. The average people that we turn away is 20. That's 7,300 people that we turn away. And sleep is a human right, and we all need sleep to function. So more than 55% of our expenses goes towards the fine, and that's not okay. And that's not okay as a city, as a human, as people with a heart and a soul. We shouldn't be getting fined. We should be helping each other, and we have a success rate. We have 40 people who have housing and have maintained it. We have 38 people who have found jobs, all because they have been able to sleep without any taxpayers' money. So we come here, and we talk, and you guys listen. Sometimes I feel like you guys don't really hear us. And maybe with this new art tax that you guys have gotten, you know, $35 from each person, I wrote you guys a little poem. Some people call it a poem. Some people call it a rap. But you guys can call it the truth. So, submitting my life to a greater cause, making sure there ain't no pause, putting my soul and everything into this place that gives me nothing, nothing but the benefits of making my voice be heard, speaking for the thousands of voices that are blurred, hidden behind corporations' greed, hearing city council lie about people's needs, criminalizing people who sleep on the streets, hiding city's problems by making sure the homeless eat. I'm sorry to tell you, but if feeding the poor is all that you can do, then rest assured the problem is you. Food, clothing, and shelter is all we need to survive. Then why am I hearing these lies? 10-year plan to end homelessness, but we spending our money so careless? $46.9 million, $46.9, can I hear it again? $46.9 million into the Bud Clark Center. Let me let you ponder, $46.9 million. Don't get me wrong, 150 people will live long. The center is a place, however, $46 million of the house's money erased. You guys can turn a blind eye, you guys can come and be our allies to use your power and your voice to make a right choice. You can continue these fines and make headlines, or you can lower your guards and come to Right to Dream's yard. Come, sit down, I invite you. Come and have a cup of tea. It's on us, it's free. Imagine, we supposed to be a team, the city and I, not me against you, not you against me, but I must be dreaming because I can still hear my people screaming, ho, ho, hey, hey, Right to Dream is here to stay. Ho, ho, hey, hey, Right to Dream is here to stay. You guys can be the dream that Martin Luther King dreamt, a revolutionary like Malcolm X, if you work hard with honor, dignity, and respect. Like my East Coast rebel brothers would say, work like Hugo Chavez every day. All we're asking is waive the fines and come and talk to us and have a space for us available to talk to you guys. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for coming. Thanks. Okay. Thank you very much. Let's move on to consent calendar. I don't believe there are any items that have been requested to be removed. Are there any this morning? If not, let's take a roll call on consent, please.
Fritz?
Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Novick?
I just want to say before I vote that I would not vote for a consent agenda that includes 242, authorized contract to provide for payment for construction of the Southwest Huber Street Sidewalk Infill Project, unless I were fully confident that the Southeast 136th Street Sidewalk Project is also going to go forward. So with that stipulation, I vote aye.
Hales.
Aye. Okay, we have a time certain item for 9:30. And I think we have Mr. Scarlett here. Yes, we do.
Item 235, amend Bureau of Development Services Land Use Services fee schedule to establish a fee for the new Type 1 Historic Resource Review.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mayor. Good morning, Commissioners. Paul Scarlett, Director for Bureau of Development Services. With Rebecca Esau, the Land Use Services Division Manager, we're here to present on the fee, new fee for the historic code, new historic code that was approved a couple weeks ago. The fee that we are presenting is in concert with the new code that was changed to reflect a streamlined process that includes a faster timeline and less cost. The cost that we have established for the new code, which is a Type 1 review process, is $475. The $475 is reflective of the cost it would take to do the work from start to finish. And to Rebecca's credit, she combed over pretty much every minute and every five-minute process that it would take to completely review the plan for minor alterations, minor work in historic districts. And so $475 is the fee that we're proposing and asking for council to accept. It would go into effect at the same time the new code goes into effect, which is May 1st. I do want to express that this is certainly still, would be remiss if I didn't include that there was great collaboration between us, the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, and to Commissioner Salzman credit, really push Susan Anderson and myself to find a solution to a longstanding problem where we had a one-size-fit-all process. This new code or new type 1 review really will be commensurate with the type of alterations that should take only 3 weeks or 2 to 3 weeks versus 6 to 8 weeks and versus $900 plus down to now $475. I'm pretty excited about that change. I think we're being very responsible. Certainly we've heard concerns and frustration about the $475 that it's still too high. And in order to lower it, if there is some form of subsidy, certainly that can be entertained. But being a operating bureau and a cost recovery bureau at 100%, that's the fee that's been calculated that reflects the work needed to complete a Type 1 review. And Rebecca, I turn it over to you if you have any specifics you'd like to share.
I don't have anything more to add unless you have questions.
Questions.
Mayor, since we have received some correspondence and emails from folks that testified last time raising concerns about the fee, I wonder if Paul could walk us through the specific concerns that have been raised, his reaction to those concerns, and what specific options the council would have to address those concerns.
Okay. Certainly we've heard the concern about the $475 and the request for, I believe, $250 is what I've been hearing would be an appropriate amount. That I can appreciate the concern. Again, being a cost recovery bureau, we've set the cost based on the cost of doing the work. And the land use program does receive some general fund, a small percentage, and certainly it could be offsetted with some general fund. Certainly this is a very difficult time with the general fund deficit. So we can present in that light, and it would be up to the council to, I guess, reach a decision how to lower the fee.
Paul, is the fee that you're proposing at 100% cost recovery?
It is.
And that's based on what assumptions?
The assumptions which Rebecca has gone into very detailed analysis of what it takes and the average amount of time to complete this review. But go ahead.
Yeah, I did an estimate on all of the steps involved, everything from taking in the application to posting the notice on our website, creating the mailing list, doing the mailing, the printing and distribution costs, postage costs, and staff time. So the staff time broke down to approximately 6.75 hours on average estimated per case, plus the additional postage costs, which came to $475.
And do you anticipate a process whereby you could evaluate your actual costs over a particular period of time and revisit the question of whether the fee is commensurate with your actual cost?
Yes, we're setting in place a system for the staff to monitor their time over the course of the next year, and we'll adjust the fee as needed the next fiscal year with that data.
And forgive my ignorance, but could you just remind us, is there any sort of self-help or sweat equity on the part of the public that would make this more streamlined for you and potentially reduce the impact on the Bureau?
Yes, we're working with our staff to get new information on our website as well as additional brochures to help customers be prepared when they are working on their applications to put it together in the best possible way, so it will go through the system as quickly as possible. The thing that takes up time is when we have an incomplete application and the customer doesn't know what they need to provide. So the more upfront work we can do in helping them prepare a really good, complete application, it will help them get through the process quickly, reduce our time, which will reduce the cost.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think I was one that felt the fee should be more around like $350, but I'm sure Rebecca's analysis is complete and thorough. So I guess my question would be, if somebody comes in with thinking they need a type 1 review and they submit the application and it turns out maybe it's replacing a door that might be under that square footage threshold, do they get their money back if we determine that they don't need to apply?
If we take in an application and it's determined that we don't need to do that particular review, we refund 100% of their fee.
Meaning they've met the exemption requirements.
What was that?
Meaning they've met the exemption requirements. We don't just say they can't do it.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm. Good. Other questions for staff? All right, thank you. And do we have folks signed up to testify on this item, Carla?
We do. We have six people signed up. The first three, please come on up, are Christine Yun, Tanya March, and Tim Eskin.
Good morning.
Morning. I'm going to talk about...
Just put your name into the record, Christine.
Oh, that's right. Christine Yoon. I'm here on behalf of Buckman Historic Association and as a member of the Portland Coalition for Historic Resources. And I'm going to talk about what I hear when I talk to people who have newly moved to Portland or who are visiting here for the first time, and they always invariably say, wow, your neighborhoods are so wonderful. They just go on, and they're all different, and they're just pristine. So this hearing may be about numbers and budgets, but it's also about the long-term health and character of our city and its attraction to tourists and future residents and businesses. By determining appropriate fees for the simplest alterations of work to one's home, this council will either support support our historic neighborhoods or leave them to the mercy of development roulette. When a developer does what is allowed by right, even if it is harmful to the neighborhood's character or livability, it is allowed. When homeowners of historic houses want to change a window, a door, add a porch roof, or restore their homes, they are being penalized for wanting to add to the cultural resources of the city by high design review fees. I am intimately familiar with the anger and frustration of homeowners in historic districts, having tried to get a historic district passed in my neighborhood for the last 6 years. Even with the approved zoning code amendments, which exempt many items and reduce the review process for simpler projects, The rallying cry of the Historic District Opposition Group has been design review starts at $1,000. And so with this new Type 1 review and proposed fee, I know that's no longer true. I just want to give you an example of where it's still a big obstacle to many homeowners. Replacing a 30 by 60 wood window, which runs about $350 to $550, depending on the quality installed, will double in cost with a Type 1 $475 review fee, and that's a huge impact to the homeowner. I'd like to close with a quote from an article on opposition that's happening with another historic district, this one in Titusville, New Jersey, where Washington landed after crossing the Delaware. It says, "What we're really asking of the community is, will they join together and say, I'll protect my property if you'll protect yours? Residents are saying no. They fear that being made to protect the historic integrity of their homes will send them to the poorhouse." Thank you.
Thank you. Morning.
Good morning. My name is Tanya March, and I am the NWDA rep on the Portland Coalition for Historic Resources. I have a number of lingering concerns about the fee, and I'm going to focus today on the non-compliance issues in the process. Owners of properties do not do some of the work that they envision on their homes upon learning of these exorbitant fees and the perceived unpredictability of the process. $475 would be 32% of the cost of a basic project, a gross fee inequity across the review types in the process. People in my neighborhood do the work without a permit. I'm not sure if in cases this is ignorance of the process, which their lawyer may claim on the outset, or that they're scoffing the fee. The zero enforcement of the city, particularly curious to me in a Google Earth digital age, pits neighbor against neighbor, which is what we've seen in the abeyance issues in Irvington, where the city is not recouping the costs by putting homeowners in abeyance, which has been triggered by them not going through the design review process and altering their home. That is not typical in the Alphabet Historic District, because a dumpster in front of an apartment building in my neighborhood could be just that they're replacing the carpet. A dumpster doesn't mean a lot to me unless it's in the right-of-way, and then the crow issues come in. On Monday, a perplexing email was sent to a member of the Portland of our group from BDS staff person Rebecca Asaw, who was mentioned twice in previous comments. She advised the coalition to raise money for the Type 1 fees with home tours. It was one of her suggestions, one of the two she felt was the most applicable. I'm already working on a home tour on May 5th to raise money for the preservation efforts at the Northwest Children's Theater. I am the vice president of the Cultural Center Board. This building, it's an original Christian Science Church, is a block from my residence and home. Home tours work to show off best historic preservation practices and highlight projects that need funding. They are not a tool that I see to use to balance for a nationally out-of-sync fee structure. A fee for Type 1 of $250 to $300 would be ideal compared to the $475 currently being proposed. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Tim Askin. I am the co-chair of the Buckman Land Use Committee and the secretary of the board, and I'm speaking on behalf of both of them today. I would like to state our strong objections to the proposed fee structure for Type 1 reviews and the inequities for vulnerable and low-income homeowners in my neighborhood. There is a vast inequity in the proportional cost of land use fees in those projects completed by homeowners, Types 1 and 2, as opposed to those incurred by developers, Types 3 and 4. For example, last year, two new attached houses of 1,800 square feet each on a vacant lot were built as infill in the Irvington Historic District. At an estimated construction cost of $350,000, the $4,973 historic design review fee actually paid amounts to only 1.4% of the construction project cost. This project resulted in extensive interactions between the builder, the neighborhood association, and the BDS planner assigned before an acceptable design was ultimately approved. And this contrasts with the basic fee structure as outlined in the last 2 years of fee schedules for types two and three projects, being that the cost should be fixed at 3% of project cost. Further contrast is a potential 2013 project in a modest home in my upcoming Buckman Historic District, where a back kitchen door and a window are replaced at a cost of $1,500. This would be a type 1 review, and the proposed fee of $475 would amount to 32% of the cost of the project. In this example, the middle-income homeowner pays a historic resource review fee at a percentage rate 20 times that of developer. I must also add that Salem does these projects at cost recovery for a flat $250. Why does it cost Portland double this? Further, BDS management always raises the specter of appeal costs in their justification of land use fees. First of all, by definition, Type 1 projects can only be appealed to LUBA. This negates the likelihood of any appeal on such a small project ever happening. As for Type 2 decisions, in the cases where it's historic design review, Irvington's experience has been that 1% of cases are appealed. Type 2 reviews for historic design cases should be substantially lower than other Type 2 cases because appeals are negligible. If we are going to be fair to all, the fees need to be assigned based on project cost. This is the case for the developer-driven projects such as demolition and new construction. Why is it therefore not the case for small projects by homeowners? Furthermore, fees for higher-end projects are artificially capped. A $6 million project such as the now typical 80 studio units at 500 square feet each and $150 per square foot gets capped at $27,000 rather than the actual baseline charge, which would be $180,000. These are the projects that take massive staff time given the complexities of apartments and commercial building code. These buildings are not paying their fair share of the costs. These buildings, without fail, go through multiple rounds of design review, multiple Landmarks Commission hearings, and design changes ordered by both staff and the Landmarks Commission. BDS simply cannot be recovering its costs on these projects, but insists on charging small projects on modest homes a 32% fee on their projects.
I want to ask you to wrap up because you've run out of time.
On behalf of the Buckman Community Association, I beg you to set the Type 1 fee at the $250 level that has been established and requested by the Portland Coalition for Historic Resources.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
The next three are Kathy Galbraith, Lenore Bajan, I believe is the last name, and Joe Walsh. Joe.
Morning.
Good morning. I'm Kathy Galbraith from the Bosco Milligan Foundation. We own the Architectural Heritage Center at 701 Southeast Grand, and we're an active member of the Portland Coalition for Historic Resources. Last month, we came and talked to you about all of the amendments to the process, and I'm here today along with my colleagues to talk to you about the minimum Type 1 review, which the fee that's proposed is still too high. When private property owners take on all the added responsibility of doing work that's in keeping with the historic character of their home or building, they should be able to feel that they're adding value to their buildings, to their neighborhood, and to the city as a whole. The fees remain a major issue, and with all due respect, calculating staff time isn't an exact science, especially for a new type review. Projects range in size and complexity, and staff have various degrees of talents, but the new type ones are the small and the simple projects undertaken by the owners of more modest homes. BDS staff has no experience in processing this new type of application, especially one that prohibits appeals. A qualified historic design review staff person, and BDS has them, can review and resolve these simple projects rather quickly. I did this for 7 years as a municipal planner, and I know how the process can work when systems are put in place. With neighborhood people working with prospective applicants before they submit, most issues have been ironed out ahead of time. This is the sweat equity that's already happening in our historic districts. The proposed Type 1 fee of $475 is too high, and you've heard the testimony about this fee equaling 32% of a project that work, the work cost $1,500. During this critical first-year test of the new Type 1, it's absolutely essential that the minimum fee be set as reasonably low as possible, encouraging owners of low to moderate means to do the right thing, encouraging them to go through the process, avoiding expensive BDS appeal times and enforcement times, and give all of us the time to determine it, the time that it really takes to process these applications. Our experience is that the fees can always go up, but they never go down. The way to pay for the perceived difference in the estimated staff time to process the new Type 1s is to eliminate the arbitrary maximum fee for Type 3 projects, which are the ones that have been described as taking the majority of staff resources and the time of public boards and commissions, and stop rewarding the Type 4 demolition applications with an arbitrarily low fee. Nonprofit fundraising is a continuing struggle, and historic design review fees that are too high make our work all the more difficult. Historic preservation is not all about rich people and their mansions. We provide information about property values and incomes. Million-dollar properties in our districts are no more than 1% of all of our resources. Next year, the North-Northeast Quadrant Plan includes a project that we're scheduled to work on with the Bureau of Planning Sustainability to do a thematic African-American National Register district in the Elliott neighborhood. If the fees remain as proposed, I think that district is going to be a serious uphill battle. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have a question. Is there a property tax break if your home is in a historic district or is registered?
You are able, if you're a contributing property in a national register district, not in a conservation district, in a national register district, which are Portland's historic districts, you can make application through the state of Oregon for what's called the Oregon Special Assessment Program. What that does is by application, it would freeze your assessed valuation for 10 years with the requirement that you invest in doing improvements to your property. It's become less meaningful with the cap on property assessments that passed some years back and are causing compression for the city's tax base and other public jurisdictions.
And do we know how many homeowners have applied for and received that?
It was higher in the earlier years when it was a 15-year break and property taxes property assessed valuations fluctuated much more than the maximum 3% raise now that the assessor can impose. In Irvington, which became a National Register District in October of 2010, I don't think there have been more than 10 or 12 applications.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, please. Just push the little button on the base of the microphone there. There you go.
My name is Lenore Bion, and thank you, all of you, for allowing me to testify. This is on behalf of taking funding away from senior centers. Not doing that. It's on behalf of having senior centers maintained at their current very efficient level. I am a yoga teacher at Hollywood Senior Center and have been for 4 years. I have a totally senior class, including a 93-year-old lady who does a lot of sewing, and she never misses the class. I have people with Parkinson's disease. I have somebody who is in a wheelchair and visualizes the exercises because they cannot do it, but they feel that the visualization is great for their muscles and their ability to move. These are people who I love. They're not only my students, but I love them because they're courageous and they're doing their darndest to keep their health up and to be proactive into very old age. I am interested in teaching older people because I myself am, as is obvious, older. I will be 82 in June. And so I work at this because my heart is there, and I live in a test laboratory, my own body. As it gets older, it informs me a lot about what is needed for my students. But senior centers are not just my pro bono donation. There are a lot of people there who are volunteers who come in, contribute their time and their efforts, their talents to teaching people or helping people. It's a political venue where a lot of political meetings are held. The senior centers offer foot care for diabetics at a price that is far more affordable than can be gotten elsewhere. Senior centers provide meals. Very frequently, the only nutritional meal that a great many of our seniors get in the course of a week. And it is an extremely important thing, and I think that this any proposal to curtail the operation of senior centers is very, very dollar foolish, because the contributions, just socially and psychologically, I would wager, avoid a lot of emergency room panic visits. And I know from my students and from the people at the senior centers how valuable this is to them. Just yesterday, not at the Hollywood Senior Center, but at the Southeast Senior Center, I was there trying to help people go through the questionnaires having to do with the arts tax and helping people to understand it so they won't be suddenly impaled on this terrible indebtedness, which a lot of them can't afford. And they don't understand the questionnaire. They never saw the postcard that came. They haven't a clue what is going on. We're trying to help people protect themselves, or at least explain it to them. And so we are all people who are working for our own peers, seniors working for their own peers. And the senior centers make this possible. It is a very valuable resource for the city of Portland. Please don't take it away.
Thank you for being here. Thanks very much. And for all your volunteer work as well. Okay, any more folks? Oh, sorry, forget it.
I'm still here.
Joe didn't want to cut you off.
Individuals for Justice takes the position. It sounds like you have more work to do on this. And it sounds very much to us like people are struggling to understand what the cost factor is when you actually come out and do what the city does as far as inspections and stuff. So it sounds like to us, like many other issues that are coming up, that you need to do more work and you need to involve more people to sit down and talk to you and not just come here for 3 minutes and try to explain their position. You're not doing enough. That's what we would say to you over and over again. Do more. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else signed up?
That's all who signed up.
So questions for staff. Could we get Paul and Rebecca? Could you come back up, please?
Mayor, I have a few questions. Okay.
So Commissioner Fish.
Paul, we had some points made in the testimony that perhaps you could give you a chance to respond to. And okay. Let's start with someone testified that the comparable fee in Salem is $250. Is that accurate? And B, do you know why there's a difference in cost?
I couldn't speak to it exactly. I know we've done analysis of different jurisdictions. Rebecca was involved in some of that research. It's usually not apple to apple, but maybe you have some perspective on it.
The regulations that we're applying are different, and they might have very simple, short set of approval criteria that are simple to explain to customers, which reduces time, and it takes less time to respond to when writing findings. That could be a difference. It could be they have different requirements regarding notification. Each jurisdiction is different with regard to their procedural requirements, the approval criteria. All of those things impact how much time it takes, and time impacts the cost.
It may also have to do with their overhead structure, or is there a contribution from their general fund that helps to offset that cost? We can research it specifically, but there are a number of those factors that conclude these type of fees.
Well, how many of these applications do we expect in the first year?
From staff, we're looking at about 35 or so per year. A number of these same reviews would have been under Type 2, which was longer and more expensive.
And so if we were to agree, if we were to set a lower figure, let's say 250 just for argument's sake, what do you anticipate is the amount you'd have to subsidize from some source?
Well, if it's 250, it would be close to 250 because it's close $475 now.
Times 30?
30.
So we're talking about
times
$6,000 or something?
Oh, excuse me. I was saying close to 250 per review times 35 because if it's 50%, which is just round up to $500, would be 250 times 35 is what you'd need to subsidize.
So we're talking about a pretty small number. We had a couple of suggestions that were offered that related to caps that we apply on Type 3 and Type 4, which might free up some money. Do you have some thoughts on those two suggestions?
We'll be working in the next 2 months on our new fee schedule for the next fiscal year, and every year when we do that, we go through and we look at what the fees are, and that's a policy question for you. If you would like to subsidize these reviews by having other applicants pay more, I guess is the
well, that's one issue for us. Help me understand this. One of the fears that we've expressed in the past as a council is that if we set the fees too high on certain things, then people will bypass the permit process and engage mm-hmm. in self-help. And I guess the best example we had was the rampant development of accessory dwelling units that were not done to code. Mm-hmm. And the way we responded to that as a council with your guidance was we simply waived the fees to encourage people to not only do it the right way, but also to encourage more development of accessory dwelling units. How did we end up paying for that?
We waived the SDC charges associated with
right.
with ADUs as a pilot project for 3 years and now have extended for another 3 years. Essentially, that's not coming out of or going into the SDC coffers. BDS permit fees are still being paid.
So they're still being charged a fee
yes.
for that. But we are subsidizing, in effect, the other fee because that fee is meant to compensate the city for the increased strain on the capacity of our infrastructure.
Yeah, a way to promote that development and encourage it.
If it was the council's will to ask you to take a second look at this and see whether there was, A, something we could learn from Salem that would bring our costs down, B, if we were to ask you for some recommendations on how we could subsidize the difference, if in fact 250 was below your cost, whether by changing caps on other fees or some other revenue source, how much time would you need to explore that?
I don't think we need any time. We've done the analysis to detail of how long it would take. And essentially, we can make the recommendation that if we want it lowered, it has to be made up with some other revenues. In fact, I asked Rebecca to round down on this proposed amount versus round up. So in terms of where else, we're a cost recovery bureau, and we did it on the basis of how long it would take to perform this review. And so it's as, I guess, empirical as you can get. To offset it would be some other funding source.
So Paul, I have no quarrel with the way you calculated the figure, and I am very admiring of it. With so quickly we've gotten to this point, and we've made progress. The concern I have with people that for whom $500 would be sticker shock and simply can't afford it, and I think we have heard from folks who are having trouble making their mortgage payments, people who are older adults in particular, and others who might be encouraged to do this outside of the regulatory system, because I think that's the risk here. We're going to be encouraging noncompliance.
Right.
My sense is that it would behoove us, Mayor, for us to take another week at this one and see what are the options to provide, to come in at a lower fee, including whether we could cross-subsidize them in some innovative way, with the goal of trying to get as much compliance as possible and reducing the overall percentage cost for these smaller projects.
Other comments? I'm inclined to agree with that. I think
And again, I have no criticism of how you got your figure and the methodology.
Exactly. The Bureau's gotten us as far as they can go applying their own cost recovery policies. I think it's really a council policy decision.
And one of the things, Mayor, that I'm concerned about is I would like to have as much compliance in the first year so we get an accurate test. And if it requires a modest investment to ensure that, I think that's money well spent rather than putting the figure at a level that may perversely encourage people to bypass the regulatory system and then at the end of the year discover that the price has to be lowered to get better compliance.
Yeah, I'm concerned both about that individual effect and on the we've had a number of people testify about the chilling effect that review and fee structure causes on the decision by a neighborhood to form a new district. And I think as a matter of council policy that we want to encourage the formation of new historic districts where they're appropriate. So if people are, you know, disincented from doing that by cost recovery, even at the most reasonable level, then that's a policy decision that I think it's fair for us to take up. So I'm interested in taking a little longer and looking at that question. Frankly, it's a question of subsidy for a public purpose. And do we want to do that? And where would the subsidy come from? And I think those are reasonable questions.
I would be prepared to make an amendment, but I think in fairness to Paul, I'd like to understand better what the trade-offs and options are and then decide whether that's appropriate.
Yep. And if I may, it wouldn't be unusual to get general fund, if you will, with land use fees. That's typical of how the land use division is funded. The majority of other programs are heavily dependent on permit fees. Land use program is a match between land use fees and general fund. So this wouldn't be out of the ordinary, and that's one way to reduce the cost.
And I think there is a public purpose in having to the public in having these historic renovations done properly. Mm-hmm. So that I'm interested in exploring that option perhaps as a bill to the general fund at the end of the year. The other thing I'm also interested in is looking at the type 4 demolition review fees and if there's a way to make those slightly more expensive. Obviously we can't make them prohibitively expensive or that we would be in mm-hmm. violation of the mm-hmm. law, but if there's a way to get some additional recovery in that mode, I'm interested in that.
Yeah, could you comment on those? Those were a couple other points that came up in testimony, the cap on type 3 fees and type 4 fees for demo.
Okay. I can talk about the cap on type 3 fees. We did one under Commissioner Salzman's direction where it was, I believe, the comp plan and zoning map amendment changes, which was a pretty high fee. And so we did an analysis, again, cost per hour and wages and all that stuff, and was able to reduce it down. To cap on fees certainly would be commensurate with what it costs to do the work. And so if there are any that's higher than that, we can look at that. I can't tell you exactly which ones those are, but we certainly can do the analysis. And relative to the type 4 demolition, Rebecca, I would have to ask you to speak to that.
Yeah, the demolition review, it's a type 4, and the BDS fee for that currently is $7,250. PBOT charge is an additional $308, so the total is $7,558. And just to get a little more clarity, are you suggesting to make that fee higher so that those applicants subsidize these reviews?
If that's legal to do so, yes.
I'm not sure that it is, but we'll talk with the city.
I'm not sure. I think what got our attention was the idea that there's a cap on the fee.
Yeah, if there's a cap on the fee,
it suggests that there are occasions when the actual costs go above the cap, so in effect we are subsidizing.
For that type 4 review, it's just a flat fee.
No, I understand, but I guess the question is, are we operating at full cost recovery, or are there instances when the costs go above the flat fee?
For that, they are so rare, there's probably only one or two that have been done, and I can look into getting that information.
I think what you're hearing is an interest, at least, in understanding whether any other fee structure can be tweaked to generate the modest amount of money needed to provide the subsidy here. Mm-hmm. And my guess, Paul, is that things like caps or the way you set flat fees for certain kinds of things during a time when there was almost no activity made more sense than during a time when there's a bull rush of permits being pulled to do all kinds of multifamily development. And the analogy I would use is we heard no criticisms about SDC fees when there was no development. Now we're hearing a lot of concerns, but the reality is there's money flooding in here, and they're going to build regardless. So I think we're less trying to induce now something to happen and more making sure that the fee structure is consistent across the regulatory.
Okay. Yeah, we'll be glad to look into it.
I just have the basic question, because I'm getting lost in the details, I confess. Are there caps on fees that big projects pay the result and aren't not getting cost recovery? Do you feel that there are?
If type 3 and type